Have you ever wondered if you can be offering a faster, less buggy application experience for your customers? With Raygun Application Performance Monitoring, you have all the information you need at your fingertips to find and fix errors and performance problems across your tech stack down to the line of code. Raygun makes it easy to monitor the impact of your performance improvements, quickly identify and resolve issues, and see how your code performs in the hands of your customers, saving you time, money, and sanity. I've personally used Raygun on my iOS apps, and when a user hits a crash, those crashes get centralized into one location, they get bucketed automatically, I'll get a call stack and an email with a line number where things were crashing. It felt to me that I got a gift for my customer in the form of a bug report that I could actually solve. Head over to raygun.com and try it out for yourself. That's raygun.com for a free 14-day trial. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Dr. Siddhal Neely. She's the Naylor Fitzhugh Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School and the author of the upcoming book, Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. How are you?
I am terrific. It's great to be with you, Scott.
I'm very excited to talk to you because suddenly everyone's working remotely. And I've been telling people for years that we should have done this. Why did it take a pandemic to get people to go home?
That's the unfortunate aspect of this for me, that it took a pandemic for people to experiment with, and not experiment with, but literally run home for safety to attempt remote work. And it's been interesting. Over the last few months, I've talked to so many people who are finding the benefits of remote work, but also the challenges.
When you said attempting, I thought that was funny because it really is. I mean, everyone was told, grab your laptop, run, and I hope that your home Comcast router holds up nicely. Enjoy.
Literally. And oh, by the way, add homeschooling to that a lot of bandwidth competition within households and at the same time deal with the worldwide crisis. So the way that it began for so many people in March 2020, was not the most relaxing way of doing it. It was actually under duress in the middle of a crisis. And every organization had to figure out very quickly what technology infrastructure they needed to set up for their employees. How do you make sure that you have cybersecurity in place? And how do you ensure that every member of your organization is fluent with all the digital tools that they quickly started to implement across their organizations? It all happened very, very fast. Mm-hmm. But you know what's interesting to me? Mm. How quickly people learned how to use the various tools to communicate. I'm talking about the digital tools that enable collaboration, video conferencing, and other things. I'm not naming any particular ones, Scott, as you notice, but people learned those aspects very fast, but it's the other aspects of remote work that's been quite challenging. It's like, how do you do this well? Because it's a skill.
There's a theme in your books, both in the titles and again thematically, and that is success. Your book, The Language of Global Success, has a very positive attitude where it attacks problems and says, well, here's what we can do to turn this problem into an opportunity that then turns into success for an organization. And you also have the word succeeding in your new book. Is that conscious?
100%. 100%. Listen, about 18 years ago is when I was firmly convinced that virtual work or work where people can be anywhere and still perform well was going to be part of the future. I just never anticipated it to be this wholesale migration of entire firms and organizations around the world. So this was a context that I was so convinced would be part of the world's future because of the technology advancements at that time. And so I've spent the last almost two decades, you know, looking at what are the issues? How do you resolve them? How do you enhance people's experiences? How do you make sure people are productive? How do you make sure people are able to connect and trust one another in this work environment? And not just remote, there's remote, but there's also global. And so the book Remote Work Revolution that you mentioned earlier literally answers questions, some of the most pressing questions that people have been asking in their remote environment. And it's all about how do I make it work? And I want to live in a world where people say, how do I thrive in this environment? And that's what my work has always been about.
This book must have been been either conceived of or, well, you know, halfway written when this all happened. Did you pivot, or was it simply an acknowledgement that the work was vital when everything went down?
Wow. So you've already picked up on two things that were very insightful and astute questions or even observations. This book had been in production for nearly 2.5 years when the pandemic hit. And in fact, I paused on another book that I was working on with one of my dear friends, Paul Leonardi, called The Digital Mindset, when remote work became the kind of format that most people were working in. And I accelerated the completion of this book. And of course, publishers were interested in it as well. And that helped. But no, a lot of the work that contributed to the book was already done. I'm talking about not only the research, the interviews, teams that helped put together an action guide related to it so that people can apply the ideas, concepts immediately upon looking at the book. So all of that was very much in place. So we just accelerated the completion of the book. But the work had always been part of what I've been developing. And in fact, the book is a culmination of several years of work.
I could write a book on remote work, but it would be a series of declarative statements on what worked for me, right? It would just be a big treatise on, hey, I'm a person who's worked a lot. I was here first, so here's what went down. But what you've done here is interviewed people, you've had conversations, you've applied research. Like, there's rigor to this.
Absolutely. Rigor and relevance. So I have talked to thousands of Scots over the years, but above that aspect of it, the remote work format, some people call it virtual, some people call it distributed work. And of course, there's always the cross-border component of it. But this is an area that's been highly researched and studied across multiple disciplines. So you can actually find rigorous research on this topic from 1976, from 1980. Wow. Oh, yeah. In fact, the first true Silicon Valley company that's been studied around remote work was in 1993, Cisco, followed by Sun Microsystems soon after. So we've been looking at remote work for decades. And there is so much information. That's the great news. We know a lot about remote work, and many scholars and information systems have also contributed to remote work. The thing about this area is that you don't usually go in a business school or a technology school or engineering school to learn this content. It's quite multidisciplinary. My own training came out of an engineering school at Stanford, where we looked at the intersection of work technology and organizations. So that's what makes it seem less accessible for any one discipline. In order to really understand this content, you have to do interdisciplinary work from your research, your consulting, etc.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that prefix inter comes up multiple times. There's interdisciplinary, there's interpersonal challenges, there's intersectional. it's not just, here's a series of tools and make sure that you download these apps and your remote working experience will be great. There's challenges that emerge amongst remote coworkers.
Absolutely. I call it the human condition, frankly. It's so interesting what happens when people are out of sight, how quickly they could get out of sync, and how quickly things can either escalate or, you know, paranoia can take place. On the other hand, those whom we have relationships with in the past outside of the remote environment, when we stop seeing them, there's a little, you know, distance that people experience, psychological, emotional distance. It's actually quite complicated because of the human condition and what people need to feel seen, heard, to trust, to be trusted. And one of the biggest worries that leaders and managers have had since March, when the pandemic hit, has been, how do I ensure that I'm connecting with and ensuring that my team members are connecting with each other? And how do I make sure that people are productive when I can't see them? And, oh, by the way, we no longer have water cooler conversations. How's this all going to work?
Yeah, I have had over the last 14 years of working remotely at Microsoft a certain sense of what I call remote worker low self-esteem, where maybe they know I had to take my son to school, or maybe they know that I took a mental health day and then I end up working harder. In my experience, remote workers tend to overcompensate for their remoteness.
Yes. Yes. Particularly when they are working in contexts where the majority were not remote workers. I think this is going to change for you, Scott, frankly, by the trends and patterns that we've been seeing over the last few months. But you know what that's called? That's called flex time. One of the gifts that remote work affords people is flex time. And I always say this, it's really important for people to arrange their work or to figure out the hours of their work in a way that's effective for them. No two people will have the same scenario. And so you might have some parents who work from 5 a.m. until 8, take their kids to school or set them up for homeschooling nowadays, and then return to work at 9:30. And then they go on for several more hours. That's called flex time. And I always tell leaders and managers that you need to give people full autonomy to structure their work. Of course, you have to make sure that when you have meetings, et cetera, that you're available and present, but you let people structure their work in a way that makes sense for their home situation. And guess what? There's robust evidence that shows when you do, people are more productive and they have higher job satisfaction. So it's a win-win-win, but you've got to trust people and you've got to let go.
Interesting. I've had conversations with members of my team. My whole team is remote. They were remote before it all went down. And I've had conversations with them where they'll say something like, oh, I'm taking the afternoon off for a dentist appointment. I'll be gone from 2, but I'll be back online at 4. Mm-hmm. And I end up having to say like, hey, I appreciate the heads up, but you are grown. Mm-hmm. And I hired a professional adult. I'm assuming you'll act as a professional adult. You don't really need to tell me like that you're gone for 2 hours. Like, just do your thing, be healthy, be happy. I hope that you're good. If you're gone for more than a half a day or a whole day, a heads up would be nice. And then I kind of wondered if I was being overly parental in doing that. But I just wanted them to understand that you are grown, I guess is the best way I can phrase it.
What you're doing too is you're saying to them, I trust you. And you can make the decisions around going, you know, to your appointment or whatever that you need to do. And I trust that you're going to get the work done that you need to. See, this is the thing. One of the disheartening things for me, and I write about this in the book, is the number of surveillance or monitoring software that people have been buying and installing since the pandemic hit, because they feel like they have to monitor people. This idea that how do I lead virtually? How do I lead people I can't see is a real fear or a real source of anxiety for many leaders and managers. But what they need to do is exactly what you do, is grant people trust and focus on outcome and not process. You need to trust that people are experts of their homes, of their personal lives and situations, and that they're going to take care of themselves, which you want, and they're going to take care of work, but that takes trust. There's no doubt that you have to coach people if you see them struggling, but giving trust is how you earn trust in remote work.
When you need to focus on building, do you want to get bogged down by your database? MongoDB is an intuitive, flexible document database that lets you get to building. MongoDB's document model is a natural way to represent data so you can focus on what matters. MongoDB Atlas is the best way to use MongoDB. It's a global cloud database service that gives you all of the developer productivity of MongoDB, plus the added simplicity of a fully managed database service. You can get started free with MongoDB Atlas at mongodb.com/atlas.
Are we seeing the, and this is a bit of a, sometimes this word can be coded language, but I don't mean it. Are we seeing a redefinition of what it means to be professional? Is professionalism a new thing? Like, I've seen my vice president have her daughter on her knee during a meeting that might have been unprofessional in a world of Mad Men or even in the 80s and 90s. But now I think that if the daughter is not bothering anyone, then that should be a thing. It was unthinkable 6 months ago.
It really was unthinkable 6 months ago that you would see someone's child appear on a call. I think you're 100% right. I don't know if it's redefining in as much as we are expanding our repertoire as people, as professionals, and developing some tolerance around seeing the whole person in ways that we hadn't before. Because if you think about it, we are entering people's homes. It's no longer the office building. It's people's homes. And, you know, your child could show up or something else could happen. Your computer could crash because of processing power issues in ways that you wouldn't necessarily see if you are part of the infrastructure, the buildings, et cetera, of your employer. And so I think people are increasing their repertoire. I think they're increasing and augmenting how they interact with one another. I was talking to a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar e-commerce company, and he was saying to me that he never would have ever ventured into a remote work arrangement for himself, nor for his company. Never would he ever have done that. But now he's the biggest fan of this way of working, and he's onboarding and giving his speeches and everything that he's doing from his home. Unheard of.
A big company that I used to work for 20 years ago, that is a big, large banking company, closed their offices. I think they actually have a 10-year lease. They're only 3 years into it. So I don't even know what's going to happen from a real estate perspective, but they shut the office down and everyone is now remote. I wonder if those kind of things, while revolutionary, may be overreactions, and then we might find ourselves in more of a 50-50 type of a place. Do we no longer need buildings?
I think we do need buildings. There will be people who will want to work at the office, even if it's 1 or 2 days a week. I think we will, but I think they're going to be smaller spaces. Mm-hmm. So here's what we know. In order for people to have job satisfaction and to be productive, remote work has to be a choice, not something that's imposed upon them. And when it's a choice, it's a different experience versus we're going to shut our building down. From now on, this is how you're going to live. You're never going to have a common professional space or an identity, or the kind of, you know, when you walk into a building, the artifact that you see, the way that the furniture is set up, all of it conveys culture. It conveys who we are. It conveys what's important to us. So for many companies, that's still going to be important, but it also means that you have to give people the freedom to work remotely or not. So if you shut down completely, you've already taken away that freedom. And, you know, we're finding in some parts of the country, remote work is particularly difficult because of space. Think about New York City. Think about Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Think about Boston. Even in our pretty luxurious waterfront areas, people are finding that they don't have enough space mm-hmm. to do remote work comfortably, especially if you have a partner at home who's also competing for space. So I don't think we're going to end up losing buildings completely. I think we need them, and people will want. Surveys have already shown. Gartner has conducted a survey, McKinsey and many other groups, and I've surveyed a number of people myself. And what we find is people say, "I want the option for one or two days a week, if possible, to be able to go in the office while maintaining a remote office at home." Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to end up in, I don't know, 50-50, but I think in a quite a hybrid situation, which is requires its own kind of skill development and management.
Yeah, it'll be another phase. I mean, before it was 90% remote, you know, on site, and now it's 90% off site, and then we're going to go and find some equilibrium, some unknown future equilibrium.
Yes.
Yeah, I wrote an article where I acknowledged, it, at least for me, that what you just to kind of click on what you just said, that remote work is supposed to be a joy. It's supposed to be a freedom. It's supposed to be a thing that we, you know, like, oh, this is wonderful. And everyone's calling me asking for advice about remote work. And the first reaction I had was, well, this is quarantine work, and that's not a good thing at all. This is a bad feeling. You're on lockdown in your own home. This is a tiny prison.
Oh, yes. Not only is it quarantine work because it's like a prison in your home, but we were, and we still are, but we were in this acute crisis mode. I'm talking about March, April. I don't think we're in a crisis mode anymore. What we're living now, people would define as a liminal state, you know, a transition state, where we are looking, as you said, for that equilibrium, and people are trying to figure out what reality will look like. But for many organizations and many individuals and teams and groups, it was a crisis. So there's the quarantine remote work, yes, indeed, but the world was also in big trouble. It still is, but it's a bit different now. Mm-hmm. So people were anxious and under such duress. You're right.
The mental health issue and also the normalizing of that, like, how are you? Like, that actually means something now? No one really knows how to answer that question. Like, how are you? I'm like, how is anyone really? Is all I can. That's the best answer I have. I mean, I'm fine. I mean, considering, like, how much do you want to know? How much time do you have to hear about how I am?
Listen, the Gartner Group conducted this survey sometimes, I think, in June, July, where only 40% of their respondents got the "how are you" from their leaders and managers.
Oh, wow. That's awful.
It's terrible. It's terrible. That, to me, was a terrible, terrible piece of data that they shared, because you have to ask, how are you? The people are looking for human connection. They also want to know if people care about them in their professional environments, in as much as they do in their personal environment. So the how are you is really important. It's really important. And, you know, ideally, Scott, people truly want to know how you are.
Hmm. Well, because, I mean, at least as a programmer, I want to know how they are, but I also have a personality type, which is I want to fix it. How can I be involved in improving how you are?
Yes. Yes. Is there anything I could do? And sometimes people just want for you to know where they are. Other times you could directly support them. I think you're very, very right. Listen, before I have 74 students this year in my MBA classroom, and sometimes I'll ask students, can you just chat in how you are? Let me just know, what's the one or two word to describe how you are? And some students will say excited, interested, tired, meh. You know, that you really get a very quick sense where people are. And I take that information and I use it for my session.
Yeah. All those bits of context matter. You know, we are just big, squishy meat bags under pressure. And the human of it all is such an important thing to not forget.
It is. And this year has been particularly stressful. I mean, it's if you sit down and truly think about all that we have gone through as people, as a country, as professionals, as family members, you know, isolated and separated from loved ones, and seeing the pain and the suffering of so many through COVID, the economic free fall that we've been saying, it is truly a uniquely difficult time. And we have to make sure that we acknowledge those things, even when we're at work trying to get stuff done remotely.
Mm-hmm. I have a boss who has a tendency, this is a thing that we have together, but he will text me on days when he knows I'm not working. And then I have a bad habit of replying. And then he will post it on Twitter and he'll say elapsed time from hello to hello, 45 seconds or whatever. And he's like, you are supposed to be not working. He actually encourages us to delete Outlook and reinstall it on Monday.
I've never heard that. Oh my goodness. Are you serious?
Well, he says two things. First, airplane mode works on the ground. That's a favorite. And that you can just delete Teams or Outlook or Slack or what, just delete it off your phone. You can always reinstall it and log in on Monday.
I'm like, my mind is so blown right now. That is.
You should interview him.
That is just incredible, though, because he understands. Listen, the other thing I talk about, and I've been talking about nonstop for the last several months, is helping people understand and live out the boundaries between their personal life and their professional lives, particularly because now they're so blurred. And you need someone like him to do that. I've started doing it as well. And it's another important best practice is when I send notes to my team during off hours or weekends, because I write a lot all the time, I will say, when we're back in action on Monday,
yes,
can you please look at this for me? So I make sure that I specify, don't touch this now, even though I'm sending it to you now.
I've actually gone one step further and I will put a do not deliver until. So I will queue things up on Saturdays and Sundays, and then I'll go into the options dialogue and say, deliver this at 9 or 10 a.m. on Monday. So it gives the illusion that it was delivered on Monday, because I know they're still looking. There's a psychic weight that is imposed upon them when they see it, even though they see the disclaimer.
You are so right. Wow. How fancy, Scott. That's actually such a good idea. And, you know, it's interesting because I wonder if it takes reprogramming ourselves in order to even do such a thing, right? Because clearly we're violating it for ourselves.
And this is the funny thing, right? Like, what is I apologize to saying this for a professor, but you know, they say those who can't teach. So I'm out there teaching everyone out about, you know, work-life balance on a Sunday.
Well, listen.
But it works for me. It feeds my spirit. I am comfortable with my work-life balance. I am not unhappy when I have a random Sunday afternoon and maybe the kids are off somewhere at another time and they're at the movies.
Yes.
And I can say, I'm going to catch up because it helps me. That's good for me, but I also know that the message that it's being sent to my team when I email them is I may be inadvertently teaching them that I want them to work on Sundays, which is not the intent.
Yes, yes. It's like this inadvertent, or even there's something about the work where you want their eyes or brain on it, but clearly you don't do it. By the way, those who can't teach, that's a myth. That's a myth. I know a lot of extraordinary teachers who still do. So
I guess I use that in a self-deprecating way to myself, because I tell everyone, you know, I teach people about how to be good at work-life balance. I just happen to have a slightly different work-life balance than they do.
Yeah, it's a different relationship with work.
Ooh, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, like different relationship.
Some people were like, oh, hey, we're going camping. I'm going to be disconnected. It's going to be so wonderful. And I'm like, that is the least exciting thing I could I do not want that for myself at all.
I get it. I totally get it.
So going forward, remote work revolution is going to come out early next year.
Yes.
And you're going to cover, as we talked about, evidence-based answers to all the kinds of issues that people are dealing with in remote work, because you really believe that this is going to change everything and enable people to succeed from anywhere. And you mean anywhere in the world.
I mean anywhere in the world, because you know what I think we're going to see too is that I think we're going to see a redistribution of populations. You talked about the building piece and companies getting rid of buildings. Many, many, many organizations are going to have a large portion of their employees who will actually be working remotely, either part-time or full-time. And many will relocate because our physical location will no longer matter. I think that's great news for talent acquisition. Mm-hmm. I think that's great news for job satisfaction. It's also great news for people who want to be able to afford homes in different parts of the world or different parts of the country. And so I truly believe that's going to be the case.
Wow. Well, it really feels like this Remote Work Revolution book is going to be an excellent follow-up, a companion book to your book, The Language of Global Success. They're almost like volume one and volume two.
In a way, the first, the Language of Global Success is a globalization book. Mm. It's what a firm goes through in a period of 5 years or more. Mm. In fact, I spent about 10 years with that company to globalize. And how do you succeed when you are working across language, across culture, across local practices, and who are the ones who are best prepared for that environment? Now, this particular book focuses squarely on this idea of people working virtually and having to develop trust to be productive, to even agile teams. There's a whole chapter on agile teams where, if you recall, the Agile Manifesto even talks about that collaboration has to be face-to-face. Mm-hmm. That is no more. For many of the agile teams are in many companies, and now they have to do things differently. And by the way, it's really working.
Indeed. Wow. There's another whole show to do about the updating the Agile Manifesto 20 years later, it feels.
Totally.
Wow.
Totally.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
I really appreciate it. I wish you all the best for now and for later.
We've been chatting with Dr. Sidhal Neely. She's the author of Remote Work Revolution, and we'll include links to that and all of her books in the show notes. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.